Committee shall come to order. The record should reflect that it is 1:38 on Monday, March the 12th. There's a quorum here present, our Senators McGuire, Senator Huggins, Senator Terrio, and myself, Senator French. We're here today to take up two bills that have been previously heard by the committee. The first is SB 13. Members should have in your packets a pair of opinions from legal services regarding different aspects of SB 13 that came up the last time the bill was discussed. I see as I'm going through my notes here, the first thing we need to do is adopt this new CS. The members should have before you CS for Senate Bill number 13, Judiciary / K for Kelo. Could I get a motion, please, to adopt that?
I move that version Kelo be adopted. Action.
Thank you, Senator Huggins. The CS is now before us. The questions that came up last time centered around some of the language in Section 1. I think, Senator Terrio, you began raising these questions, but we all eventually joined in on them. And the issue is whether public funds are prohibited for communications sent during the 30 days immediately preceding a state election. And the issue came up as to whether that meant POET accounts, that meant other monies. And the answers that we got, there are two legal opinions. One's essentially a one-paragraph opinion, and the other takes a couple pages. Mm-hmm. The first one deals with the POET account issue, and the opinion states that the committee is asked, does the language of Section 1 prohibit a legislator from communicating with constituents by newsletter or other means if the communication is paid for by private funds or from a POET account? And it says the answer is no. However, there's an important footnote at the bottom of the page, which is that there are separate legal restrictions on the management and use of POET funds that may affect the publication of newsletters, but not under Section 1 of the bill. So that lets us know that the real issue is use of public funds, office account funds, for those communications, not private money and not POET money, although POET money is dealt with separately. The other question was a question raised by Senator Wilkowski, I'm sorry, who's next door presenting a bill. And his question had to do with, Section 6, if you turn to that section, whether the prohibition there in Section, that's not Section 6 anymore, it is... Sorry, it is 6? In the K version? It has to do with the definitions. Yep, thank you. The issue is whether the prohibition on performing legislative action or administrative action, whether that included, his example was researching a bill, if you may remember from the discussion there, whether a lawyer who researched a bill would be deemed to be doing legislative action and therefore subject to an Ethics Act violation, a claim of violation. And the gist of the opinion, if you haven't had a chance to read it, is essentially no, that it wouldn't be an Ethics Act violation. And so that, I believe, clears up those two questions the members had the last time we met. Any follow-up on those two points? Senator McGuire.
Okay, on the first, Mr. Chairman. No, I'm looking at the 30-day prohibition, and I agree, and that's a good opinion. Back on the POET, page 3, 8 through 9, do we mean the general or the primary election?
I would take it to be either. A state election is a state election, so it would be 30 days before the primary or 30 days before the general.
Okay, so do we want to say that, or do we just want to keep it a state election? Do we think we need to say it?
I
keep it general. Is the drafter here?
My opinion, it's clear, but I'd be happy to defer to the will of the committee if there's a strong feeling any other way.
Okay.
Hearing
so on
seeing.
The record, then it's 30 days before the primary.
And then again.
30 days before the, okay, and then again, and so then there's a gap. So like, let's say for an example that you had a primary, but you didn't have a general. So 30 days before your primary, and then you wanted to go on to communicate so at some level after the primary with your constituents, but so are you allowed to do that again?
I think if your name is on the ballot, you're in an election. You and I don't think of ourselves as having an election if you're unopposed.
True.
But it's still an election.
No, and I get that point, but I'm setting up the hypothetical for why someone might want to communicate in, say, September with their constituency. I don't tend to do newsletters, try not to when there's an election, but let's say you've gone through your primary, you want to communicate. Are you saying then it's 30 days before the primary, then there's a gap again, and 30 days before the general?
That's the way this law reads.
Okay.
Yeah. Any other questions or comments on that point? And questions or comments on the other, do you have other issues about the second opinion, Senator McGuire?
Nope.
No. Let's set that aside then and skip over to Section 6 on page 7. And I mentioned Senator Terrio before the meeting, and I don't know if I had a chance to actually, I did have a chance to give this to you, Senator Huggins, last time we met on the snowstorm, on the snowy afternoon that we had to cancel the meeting. I'd gotten an email from Drew Pierce, who was concerned about the on line 13 of page 7, the "and for 1 year thereafter" prohibition on what sorts of work a legislator may do. And Ms. Pierce pointed out to me in her email that she felt that this phrase would prohibit her from leaving state employment and going to work for the federal government. And so it struck me that that was not what we were after, that's not what we're intending, and that the service she was rendering the state and the federal government was just as valuable as that which she rendered while in state employment. And so for those reasons, I'm going to propose an amendment that we, on line 13, page 7, strike the words "and for 1 year thereafter." Senator Terrio.
So what Senator Pierce was really concerned about, what she used herself as an example, you know, she's filling this federal pipeline coordinator role, which is tremendous. Yeah. There's a tremendous benefit for the state of Alaska. And she wanted to make sure that type of activity would not be preempted. So clearly, if we strike that, she couldn't take on that role while she was serving as a legislator, and that's probably appropriate. But you just want to make sure that if I were offered a similar job, taking the benefit of what you learn in the way the state system works into the arena in the federal government or some other place where it would be tremendously beneficial to the state, that's not preempted.
That's the idea. And indeed, if you look at it more globally, the idea is not to be getting paid by two masters while you're here in the building. Once you leave, there are plenty of restrictions on the types of jobs you can take, the types of lobbying you can do. But the real idea behind Section 6, which again is kind of the heart of the bill, was to keep you from wearing two hats while you're here in the legislature. So taking that phrase out, I don't think weakens the bill, and it keeps us open to the kinds of things, the opportunities that come along from time to time with other governments. So, Senator Huggins.
I don't disagree with you, but on the other hand, what sort of abuses does that potentially raise for us?
The I guess I'll turn to you and ask you. I'm not sure.
I don't know. I hadn't really thought about it, other than it may fit Drew's case perfectly.
Right.
But you know, we have the one year provision, as I recall, another element, 2 years, in another respect.
Those are just for the listening public. Those are for lobbying and for taking jobs that you voted for an increase in the salary, right? So those are on the books, and I think we all agree that you shouldn't vote to increase the salary of a commissioner, say, hoping for a change in administration, and then land that commissioner's job having increased the salary the year before. I don't think the public would stand for that. But I appreciate you bringing this up and giving us a minute to think about it, Senator Huggins, because this is the heart of the bill, and yet I don't want it to be so expansive that we trip ourselves up and lose opportunities.
Mr.
Senator Terrio.
I think those other sections of law hopefully do get to the areas of concern that the general public would have. As you mentioned, you know, you do something to gain knowledge on the legislative system, and then you go into lobby, you know, for a corporate client, and we have the 1 year prohibition on that now. And you mentioned the either creating a position or changing the salary of a position and then moving into that position. There's a prohibition on that already. So I think that gets at the abuse And we don't want to strike this so tightly here that we lose the potential benefit of somebody acting in a similar manner as former Senator Pierce, where it's clearly to the benefit of the citizens of the state to have her in the position that she's in. So.
With that, more discussion on the proposed amendment. I'll just make it formal. I'll move that we strike that language. Is there opposition? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted. That brings us back to the bill as a whole. The members will remember that the Section 6 is the kind of the heart of the bill. It's the idea behind the what was initially filed by our colleague Senator Stevens, and the rest of the provisions were added with the suggestions of the Ethics Committee to bring up to date some of the provisions of that code. Is there anybody here online that would like to testify with respect to SB 13? We've got two folks on to answer questions, but Joyce Anderson and Brooke Miles. Any members of the committee have questions for either Brooke or Joyce while the bill is still before us? Senator McGuire.
No question, but to both Brooke and Joyce, something I think that would be really helpful for lawmakers when we're done with this session, because I know you guys are really busy all the time, would be to put together, in the way I always think of it, is like a matrix. When I ask, if I'm working on a bill, I say, well, how do other states approach this? I always ask for a matrix, you know, sort of how does it compare on different things? Something that I think that would be helpful for lawmakers would be a kind of a pamphlet that would have a matrix of, here's what the kind of work you can do while you're in office. Here's the kind of work that you can do, can't do, and or could do 1 year after. And then after that, what do you go into? And then aligning the work, I think, comes the disclosures and so forth in a real simple way, because you guys do a great job when we have questions and we'll bounce them off Joyce and say, well, is this something we could do or couldn't do? But with all the changes that are coming about that are real positive, I think it would be helpful to have that laid out in such a way that that's just a real easy way for a lawmaker to know. It's just a thought.
Good suggestion. Other questions or comments on SB 13?
Mr. Chairman, just on Section 6, trying to remember all the debate that we had previously. Just wondering if, say, that I was, you know, in my elected spot for 4 years, come up on an election, and the Republican Party wants me to act as a campaign or candidate coordinator in Interior Alaska. Would that be preempted from this as under or political action, that the party wouldn't be able to pay me to be sort of a campaign coordinator?
And did your hypothesis, I'm sorry, Senator Terry, to interrupt, but did your hypothesis, you said something about an election. Did you win or lose that election?
Well, no, say I'm not in an
election.
You're
not up.
It's my year
summer
where
activity.
I'm not up. Right. And I get, because I just got elected this time, so in the next election, I'm not running. But what if the party wanted to pay me to be a coordinator for local Republican activities? Would that be preempted because it's political action?
We discussed last time that a lot of folks politic, you know, folks in this building, legislators, go home and politic. They help other campaigns. They volunteer. They do this and that. In my view, it would be problematic. I think you'd have to probably get a letter from someone or get a ruling ahead of time, but in my view, it would be problematic to accept paid political work outside the building while you're still a legislator. That's my glancing read at the statute.
Okay, so I was trying to remember from our discussion last time whether it is all attached to legislative action, because in our elected capacity, we engage in legislative action, and we shouldn't have, as you said, the second master for the same work that we're elected to do. But clearly, if I'm, you know, helping candidates, or is that legislative action? Is that tied to legislative action? And is that, when there's that connection to legislative action, that which I'm already supposed to be doing and I get paid by the state to do, I shouldn't get paid from a second source for the same work. But clearly in my legislative capacity. I wasn't elected to coordinate campaigns the next time around. That's something I choose to do or don't do. That's not one of the duties that the people elected me to do.
Sure. Other questions or thoughts on Senator Terrio's observation? Are you suggesting
Ask for an opinion.
About that, I mean, find out whether...
Just ask for it.
Right?
Yeah.
Mm.
I mean, we're clearly not supposed to be paid by anyone other than the state of Alaska for legislative action, administrative action. I'm not quite sure why we put in political action. The state doesn't pay me currently for political action.
I am looking in the packet for a definition of political.
And just for the record, I've never been paid by the party to perform that function. But I'm just wondering what's our compelling reason to do so.
Why don't we take a brief at ease while we look up the definition of political? We're back on the record, and I've been helpfully supplied with a definition of political action. Thank you, Mr. Jones. Political action under AS 2460-990, subsection 13, political action means conduct in which public officials, including legislators or legislative employees, use their official position or political contacts to exercise influence on state and local government employees or entities. It includes, but is not limited to, endorsing and pledging support or actively supporting a legislative matter, a nominee, or a candidate for public office. So this would prohibit you for doing that for money, for supporting a candidate for money. It would prohibit you from being a paid political consultant rather than an unpaid one. It would prohibit you from running someone's campaign for money, I take it, supporting a nominee. I guess in my view, it's better, it hasn't been a problem. I haven't heard of anybody being paid to work politics outside the building. We're all kind of junkies, and we'll probably most of it do it for free, or not at all. And at some level, your concern suggests a limitation on a person's right to earn a living outside the building. At another level, since it hasn't been a problem, I'll submit to the will of the committee as to whether to take that out or not, but I guess I'd rather have it in.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with you. The only thing I want to make sure is that compensation, is that defined as well, Mr. Jones? Because I want to make sure that it means for money, not because...
Right.
Does that make sense? I'm trying to think of what other compensation there could be, but friendship, you want the person to win.
Right. Mr. Jones, you have an opinion as to what compensation means? I know you're not here to testify on this bill, but you are a lawyer in this area.
Mr. Chairman, my name is David Jones. I'm an assistant attorney general for the state of Alaska. And through the chair, Senator McGuire, I don't know. I'd have to check the definitions, and I gave my book away.
Give it back.
Brief at ease. Judiciary Committee is back on the record.
Mr. Chairman, Senator McGuire, there is a definition of compensation in 2460-990A4. And that definition reads, compensation means remuneration for personal services rendered, including salary, fees, commissions, bonuses, and similar payments, but does not include reimbursement for actual expenses incurred by a person.
Okay.
Fair enough. It seems to pretty clearly indicate money.
Totally. Yeah.
Everybody satisfied with that? More concerns, Senator Terrio? I think it's a useful example and discussion. Other areas of concern about the bill? Hearing and seeing none, what is the will of the committee?
You want a motion to move the bill out, Mr. Chairman?
Okay. I'd be receptive to a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move CS for Senate Bill House Bill, CS for Senate Bill number 13 as amended today with individual recommendations and attached, are they zero fiscal notes? Yes, zero fiscal notes.
There's been a motion to move the bill out of the committee. Is there an objection? Hearing and seeing none, SB 13 is move on to the next committee referral. Take a brief at ease to get the paperwork squared away. Committee will come back to order. The next item of business before us is CS for Senate Bill number 64, Judiciary. We do have another committee version here. That's backslash echo. If someone would move that.
I move that echo be adopted.
The CS is now before us, backslash echo. Let me bring, I took a little time before this meeting and ran through the bill, and I'm going to give you a quick overview of what's in the bill now since we've extracted some of the portions earlier. So, with your indulgence, Section 1 of the bill, it basically calls for electronic filing for campaigns, for governor now, and for initiatives now, and for legislators beginning in May of 2009. Section 2 calls for e-filing of legislative financial disclosures beginning in July of 2008. Section 3 brings the level of the disclosure level for public employees down to the same level as the level for legislators. So you'll see that's why all the 5,000s are lined out and the 1,000s are written in. That's to make them essentially be on the same plane as we are. Section 4 requires e-filing of executive branch employees' financial disclosures beginning in July of 2007. Section 5 adds 5 different boards of directors to the list of those individuals who have to make disclosures. And finally, Section 6 deals with the a presumption with respect to gifts given by a lobbyist to an executive branch employee. That's a quick overview of what's left in this SB 64. We have with us Mr. Jones here today to answer any questions that members may have. We also have online Brooke Miles from APOC to answer questions. And I know I had a couple to start out with. And I want to work from back to front. And the first questions I had were about Section 6, the gifts given to executive branch employee. And let's, I guess we're going to divvy this up into citizens and lobbyists, because there's one provision for citizens, one provision for lobbyists. Why don't you explain to the committee what paragraph A at the top of page 5 does and the distinctions that it draws?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am still David Jones, Assistant Attorney General with the State of Alaska. The bill in Section 6, subsection A, would establish a presumption that any gift from a lobbyist is intended to influence the official duties, actions, or judgment of the executive branch official receiving the gift or that official's immediate family member, unless the person receiving the gift is an immediate family member of the lobbyist. The reason we establish that exception is to avoid ridiculous results where a lobbyist is giving a gift to a family member and that family member happens to be a member of the executive branch. We don't want to prohibit gifts in those circumstances. Generally, the rule that applies now is that a gift is prohibited to an executive branch member if it would be reasonable to infer that that gift is intended to influence the performance of official duties, actions, or judgment. That is a fairly flexible standard. It's an objective standard in that it is based on what a reasonable person would infer, but it's not a clear, bright line test. Therefore, the current statute also requires that members of the executive branch report any gift that exceeds $150 in value if the gift is given because of the executive branch member's official position or if the executive branch person receiving the gift has authority to take official action affecting the person giving the gift. And so that's how we deal with the fact that the current statute has that sort of flexible standard to it. Given the size of our state and the fact that many of us know each other in very different capacities, officially and personally, the familial relationships that exist throughout the state, we have to recognize the reality that we're going to run into each other in various different circumstances, sometimes as part of our official duties, and sometimes because we're neighbors, friends, folks that play softball together, things like that. And the current statute allows that. What the governor has proposed is that for lobbyists, we establish a presumption that any gift given to an executive branch member is intended to influence that executive branch member. Because it's a presumption, it allows us, through the designated ethics supervisors, to grant exceptions where the circumstances indicate that no reasonable person could infer that the gift was intended to influence official judgment. And I think we've discussed before the example of next door neighbors, where, for example, I'm an administrative clerk. I live next door to someone who happens to be a lobbyist. The lobbyist gives me a gift because I'm getting married. I have absolutely no influence over matters that interest the lobbyist officially or professionally. The lobbyist is giving me a gift because I'm getting married. And this would allow me to go to my designated ethics supervisor, explain the circumstances, and get a ruling from the supervisor on whether it's appropriate for me to accept the gift.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Senator Theriault.
Thanks. I was going to go to the statute book here and see which lobbyists we are talking about under the definition 244541. Quite often we use the one term, and of course there are two different kinds of lobbyists. There's the contract lobbyist, and then there's people. There are people that just register because they spend a certain amount of time down here. I don't live next to, nor do I think I will ever live next to a contract lobbyist, but my next door neighbor might in fact be the head of the local PTA, come down on a PTA trip and have to register, quote unquote, as a lobbyist. And I don't know that the public has a whole lot of concern about that type of lobbyist. Most of their concern is with the full-time contract lobbyist. So who all gets swept up in this definition?
Senator Terrio, through the chair, this would include both the full-time professional lobbyists and the representational lobbyists, because they are both required to register with the Alaska Public Offices Commission. Volunteer lobbyists are not required to register, although they may voluntarily register. They would not be covered by this requirement because the way it's worded, it applies only to those that are required to register.
Okay, maybe can you refresh my memory, the difference between a volunteer lobbyist? If I come down here with a certain group, and they pay for my airfare, maybe cover the cost of me staying at the hostel, does that put me over into the, you know, out of the realm of a volunteer lobbyist now?
Senator Terrio, through the chair, the distinction, as I understand it, between volunteer and representational lobbyists is that volunteer lobbyists represent the entities as lobbyists only in public meetings, whereas representational lobbyists can meet one-on-one with legislators outside of public meetings. And I hope, if I'm incorrect, that Brooke Miles will correct me.
Why don't we just stop for a second and do a check on that. Ms. Miles, are you on the line?
I am, Mr. Chairman.
And do you agree with Mr. Jones's representations with respect to representative lobbyists and volunteer lobbyists?
I think I can make it a little more clear, Mr. Chairman.
Please go
Let on. Me put on the record that my name is Brooke Miles and that I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Public Offices Commission. The lobbying law views two different types of individuals as professional lobbyists. Those are the individuals who are paid a fee or a salary. Now, contract lobbyist clearly is a professional lobbyist, and those individuals are required to register before engaging in lobbying activities. For persons who are employed and receive a salary and to whom lobbying is only a part of what they do for their employer, are entitled by statute to 10 hours in a 30-day period grace from requiring to register as a lobbyist. When those individuals who are salaried employees spend more than $10 in any 30-day period, then they are required to register also. In addition to that, the Commission has a regulation that stipulates that an individual who does not receive salary and does not receive a fee, but whose expenses are paid for in whole or in part by the entity that she or he is representing as a lobbyist, is the representational lobbyist. Those individuals are required to register. They are not required to submit lobbyist reports. The entity that they, on whose behalf they lobby, submits a quarterly employer of lobbyist report that includes all expenditures paid on that representational lobbyist's behalf. And then, as Mr. Jones has said, volunteer lobbyists, a person who is not being paid by anyone else and who represents herself to the legislature, is not subject to the law, and if wishes to, can file a registration and appear on our listing, but would, of course, not be required to file reports, and is also not subject to other restrictions in the lobbying law regarding political activities, et cetera. I hope that was helpful, but it could have caused more questions, which I'll be happy to answer.
Let me just see if I can recap, just for painful clarity.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. The contract lobbyist and the representational lobbyists are both required to register under 2445041, and the volunteer lobbyist does not have to register under that same statute. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Wonderful. Okay, I think now we know the universe of the individuals that we're concerned about. More questions, more follow-up, Senator Terrio, based on your inquiry. My question surrounds the de minimis rule or the idea of some gift or some gratuity being so small as to be unworthy of consideration. And I guess what I have in mind are, you know, someone borrowing someone else's cell phone when your plane lands in Sitka and not in Juneau, or someone sharing a cab ride to downtown Juneau when your plane comes in at midnight, or someone giving someone a magazine that they're finished reading. But if you bought a magazine at a newsstand, you know that they can be $8 or $9 sometimes. Magazines are unbelievably expensive when you go to the newsstand. Those are the things that I'm, you know, I've got on my, or someone, you know, saying, let me, you know, buy you a sandwich or a cup of coffee, when, you know, Starbucks coffee can be up around $5. So I guess I'm wondering whether there shouldn't be some level below which we say to ourselves, we're just not going to get too excited about someone influencing someone else's decisions because of a cell phone, a cab ride, or a used magazine.
Mr. Chairman, I think there are instances in which it would be unreasonable to assume that the gift is intended to influence. And I think that's the advantage of using a presumption rather than a bright line rule. The difficulty is that it would require the executive branch member to report that and get a ruling from the designated ethics supervisor when, for example, a lobbyist gave a used magazine to the executive branch official. On the other hand, if we create a bright line de minimis test, say $5, $10, how is the public going to feel when every time a lobbyist wants to talk to me, a lobbyist pulls me aside and takes me out to Starbucks and buys me a $10 cup of coffee or $5 cup of coffee? Does that enhance the public's confidence in the members of the executive branch to know that, yeah, whenever they want coffee, they call a lobbyist, go get a free cup of coffee, and sit down and talk about business? And that's the reason we went with the presumption. And I agree, it could be a difficulty for those who commonly receive gifts of small value from lobbyists. But we believe it's more important to support the public's faith in the integrity of their public officials.
And let me make sure I understand how this works then. The no one would be the wiser if the report's not made. Is that right?
That's correct.
Under this law as it's proposed, or under the law as it stands right now?
That's correct. Mr. Chairman, ultimately, the first line enforcers of any ethics law is the member of the executive branch or judicial branch or legislative branch involved.
And I guess I'm just trying to be alert to the idea of, you know, some sort of harassment, if you will, of the executive branch employees by the public, if you will, or by anybody else, because of those de minimis, or what I perceive as de minimis exchanges of social interaction rather than the attempt to curry favor through a cup of coffee. But maybe we should err on the side of caution. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, that's what I do, and I could give you an example. 2 weeks ago, I shared a cab ride with someone that turns out was a lobbyist. And without me knowing it, this lobbyist paid for the entire cab ride before I got to my stop. So the next morning, I dropped off an envelope with my share of the cab fare, and it was easy enough to fix. And I think it's easy enough for me, when I know it's a lobbyist, to avoid receiving a gift from a lobbyist.
Senator McGuire.
And you know, I completely agree with most of what you've said, and I think it's better to err on the side of caution. The difficulty, and right now I'm thinking of an example of a baby shower. You know, the population is small in Alaska, and we have friendships that go back many years, particularly as it pertains now to family members outside of, I think we've all become careful when it comes to lobbyists, and we know who the contract lobbyists are. I think Senator Terrio's right. It gets harder down the chain to kind of know sometimes who the others are trying to influence us. But now we're talking about their family members as well, and then our family members as well. And so let's say there's a baby shower, and let's say I'm a male member of the legislature, and my wife is having a baby shower.
As a point of order, let's stick with the executive branch, because remember, this is for executive branch
that's
only.
That's right. Sorry. Okay. So, public watching. So that's right. Thank so, so what would I be? I would be a deputy commissioner, and my wife was having a baby shower, and the baby showers are usually done by friends, not the person that's having the baby. And the list is usually generated by the friends, and that's the whole point of it, because a person would never ask somebody for gifts for themselves. It's inappropriate, even when you're not a public official. And so the list is generated, it goes out, and it goes out to somebody who's been your longtime friend. You're the wife of a deputy commissioner, and it happens to include the wife of a lobbyist. And that person shows up with a gift bag that includes a onesie and a hat and something else. So then what do you do? So walk me through that hypothetical.
Senator McGuire, through the chair. First of all, this provision would not apply to gifts from an immediate family member of a lobbyist. So the fact that the wife of a lobbyist or spouse of a lobbyist gives the gift wouldn't be covered by this. It has to be a gift from a person required to register as a lobbyist. Okay. The reference to immediate family member is one, to an immediate family member of the person receiving the gift, and secondly, an exception for gifts where the lobbyist is an immediate family member of the person receiving the gift.
Okay.
But let's pretend in your hypothetical that it's the lobbyist, him or herself, that's making the gift. Then, in almost all circumstances, it would be unreasonable to infer that the intent of that gift is to influence official action.
Okay.
So the person receiving the gift reports it, or if the person receiving it is an immediate family member, the executive branch member, that member reports it, gets an approval from the designated ethics supervisor, and it's covered.
Okay. Okay.
Follow-up, Senator McGuire?
Nope.
No. Back to reporting, because I think that strikes me as being one of the areas where there's a little bit of a weak link. It sounds like you're very cautious, and that's obviously the way to be, but maybe not everybody else is. The rules as we're setting them up would require essentially all gifts, it seems to me, from a lobbyist to be reported because of the presumption, correct?
Mr. Chairman, either reported or refused.
Or an opinion sought before they're received. So you can either seek, if someone offers you something, you can either go seek an opinion, you can accept it and report it, or you can refuse it. But what about non-lobbyists? If a lobbyist for BP can't give an executive branch employee a cup of coffee, why can the president of BP do the same thing without us coming to the exact same conclusion? That is, the president, you know, if a lobbyist wants to influence your action with a cup of coffee, why isn't the president of BP, and I don't mean to pick on BP, Company X, why doesn't the president of Company X want to influence you just the same?
So, Mr. Chairman, if I understand your question correctly, it's pretty much why pick on lobbyists? And I think the reason is they're in the business of influencing official action. That's their job. And that's why it may seem that they're being targeted, but really it's a recognition of the reality. Their job is to influence legislative or administrative action. And so we presume that what they're doing as part of their job, unless the circumstances indicate otherwise.
And yet, I think for a member of the public, the president of Company X, handing out cups of coffee at the airport, is engaged in the exact same behavior, or at least has the exact same object in mind. It's hard to escape that.
Mr. Chairman, I agree that we could come up with situations that would create the same sort of impression. And in those circumstances, where it's clear, where a reasonable person would infer that the intent is to influence official action, the executive branch official should refuse the offer.
Or report it.
Or report it and get approval. But if the intent is to influence official action, the executive branch member should decline the gift, regardless of value.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions about this section? I also want to turn the members' attentions. You should have received it. Everybody get this ahead of time? Everybody got ahead of time a packet. While we have this executive branch ethics bill in front of us, there was a big news story yesterday about the previous executive's use of the jet. And the packet addresses some of the opinions that have been generated about that in the past. And I guess for me, my question is fairly simple and fairly global. That is, in your view, Mr. Jones, is there a problem with the way the law is written, or was there a problem, in your view, with how the former governor interpreted the law? Does that make sense? Do we need to tighten the law to make it clear how state equipment is used by the executive branch?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think we need to tighten the law. With respect to your other question, whether I think the way things were handled previously was incorrect or in violation of the law, I'm a bit constrained. I don't want to prejudge a case that may or may not come to us in the Attorney General's office. Under the Ethics Act, complaints are confidential unless the accused in a complaint waives confidentiality.
Fair enough, and I don't want to even lead you in that direction. So don't mistake my question for that. I just want to make sure that while I have this bill in front of me, while I have the opportunity to work on this, that we don't miss an opportunity to fix something if something needs fixing. Let me make sure I understand the state of the law. 3952.120A6 is the statute that prohibits the use of state equipment for partisan political purposes, exempting, of course, the governor's house for limited purposes. Does the same statute, where does the 50% rule come in? Maybe you can explain that to me. Where does that 50% rule pop up with respect to that statute which prohibits the use of state equipment?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe there is a 50% rule. You may be referring to the primary purpose analysis that we applied in the opinion that I wrote in 2006. I suspect that that's what you're referring to.
And go ahead and explain to me and the public how those two ideas intersect.
Okay. The reason I say there isn't a 50% rule is I think that's different from a primary purpose rule. Because, for example, as a lawyer, I might be heading up to Fairbanks for a 10-minute hearing, and that's the primary purpose of my trip. I wouldn't be going otherwise. But while I'm there, I might go look at the university or go to the museum, enjoy Fairbanks. And there's a personal benefit to me if I do it on my own time. But still, the primary purpose of my trip was that 10-minute hearing that I had in court. So I don't think a percentage-based standard works in terms of determining the purpose of a trip. The analysis that we did in the opinion that I wrote was a difficult one. And sometimes in our jobs, we're required to call balls and strikes. And sometimes that ball is right on the line. And I'll tell you, I wrestled a whole lot over this one, both before and after I wrote it. the intent in referring to these mixed purposes trips was to cover an instance in which, for example, an executive branch official is heading to a particular location for state business and just happens to have an opportunity to do something else while he or she is there. Not to say, okay, I want to do political activities here, there, and the other place, and so I'm going to come up with some state business that I can do while I'm here, there, and the other place. That was the intent. And that's why, when I wrote the opinion, we said, it is important to apply careful judgment in determining the primary purpose of a trip. Indiscriminate use of state aircraft for trips combining official duties and partisan political activities will risk both violating the Ethics Act and inviting public criticism. So I think in some ways the main point of the opinion may have been lost. The question to us was, is it okay to use state aircraft for partisan political purposes? The answer is no. Then the subsidiary question was, well, if I'm on state business, while I'm there, can I engage in partisan political activities? And the answer is yes, so long as the primary purpose of that trip truly was state business.
That's a distinction that you can appreciate, and I think I can appreciate if you think really, really hard. But frankly, I think it's a distinction that may be lost on the public.
Yeah.
I don't know if the public can honestly make a meaningful difference between a political rally that you just happen to decide to go to once you're there and a political rally that you went to after you'd been to a bill signing that you planned ahead of time. And so that's something I think, while we've got this bill in front of us, the committee's going to have to spend some time wrestling with. Well, let me ask you a couple follow-up questions, or did I interrupt you? I don't mean to interrupt you.
No, Mr. Chairman, you did not interrupt me. I was about to launch in a different direction.
Okay. Let me ask you about, you can tell I like the de minimis rule. I think that's just a nice way to get at things, and I followed your good explanation earlier about why it would be awkward in the prior section we were talking about. Should there be a de minimis provision here? Since, in my view, it's almost impossible to separate the different hats we wear. And I pick up the telephone and I need to get hold of my wife, and I pick up a state telephone and I call her, and if I owe the state money later on for long distance charges, I'll pay it. But we call that de minimis when I use the state's electrical current to carry my voice as long as I pay the freight. Same with the computer, same with my desk. I mean, it's almost impossible to get our personal lives out of the building. And from time to time, it's almost impossible to keep your political life out of the building. It seeps in. You inadvertently carry in a campaign brochure. You inadvertently, have your belongings in your legislative office while there's something related to a political campaign in it. And so I don't expect the governor or anybody else to be able to do any better than I do at separating the facets of your life. But folks also expect, particularly when there's state travel is expensive. It's difficult to get around the state and pay your way. And so I just wonder whether there shouldn't be a de minimis, the same de minimis standards that applies to me using a state chair, telephone, computer, to the executive branch when it comes to the politicking that inevitably happens every 4 years in that branch.
Mr. Chairman, there is already, to some extent, a de minimis rule in the Ethics Act. In Alaska Statute 39.52.120D, it says, a public officer other than the governor and lieutenant governor who, during the work days, engages in political campaign activities other than minor, inconsequential, and unavoidable campaign activities, and there's the de minimis rule, shall take approved leave for the period of campaigning. The difficulty when you apply that to the governor and lieutenant governor is that they aren't under the same leave system as other executive branch officials. Their jobs aren't full-time jobs. They're all-the-time jobs, which is part of the reason we provide a residence for the governor. And they don't get to take leave and say, okay, count this against my leave balance. Everything they do is presumed to be related to their official duties. So there is a de minimis rule with respect to other members of the executive branch. There isn't one under existing law for the governor or lieutenant governor.
And Senator Theriault.
So getting to the example that you gave, you are compelled to be in the court system for what may be a half hour, maybe even 15-minute hearing. I mean, the judge says, can't do it telephonically, you have to be here. But then if you do some other activity, depending on the level of activity that you participate in the rest of the day, you may take half a day off. And as an employee, you have that ability to do that, to make that separation between what was official business and what was not. But I understand your point that the governor, just like we don't have, you know, the leave bank or paid leave. So we can't put in for half a day off.
We should. there's weeks when you wanted a half a day off.
And Mr. Chairman, you know, if I'm up in Fairbanks for my 10-minute hearing, my flight doesn't leave for another 5-7 hours, whatever it might be, and I want to go to hear a candidate speak and perhaps make a donation and take leave to do that because I am covered by the leave system. Does that change the primary purpose of my trip? I don't think so. I was still up there because I had to attend this hearing in court. Yeah, I took advantage of it while I was there to listen to a candidate, perhaps make a donation. But still, the primary purpose of my trip was state duties, to attend the court hearing.
It may be that the job of governor is just so inextricably linked with his or her, you know, activity that there's no way to fashion a rule that separates out those different hats. But I do let me just finish this thought and we'll hop over. I guess the next question is okay, fine, you've used a state asset, your primary purpose was to go sign a bill, it turned out, you know, you went to two fundraisers and gave a speech. How do the people of the state then sort of recapture that lost value, if you will, in the use of a state resource to do that politicking when it's been done at the state treasury's expense?
Mr. Chairman, I have two parts to the answer. First, the Alaska Public Offices Commission has indicated that in those circumstances there should be an allocation between the state duties and the political functions, and that the campaign should pay for that portion that's attributable to the political activities at a commercially reasonable rate within a commercially reasonable time. In addition,
let me just stop you right there, because that seems to be one of the rubs, if you will, the commercially reasonable rate vis-a-vis, is that always compared to, say, an airplane ticket versus the use of I can't go help but going back to the jet. I mean, the flying that jet is not like grabbing even a first class seat. And to be perfectly fair, it's not like, you know, some candidates get rides on corporate jets, and frankly, I don't think that should be reimbursed at a first class seat compensation either. It's just way more valuable. So can you just speak to the value question for a second?
Mr. Chairman, I can. And I think there are two ways to analyze it. One would be to say, what is the benefit to the recipient? The other is, what is the cost to the state? And if you're looking at the cost to the state, certainly it makes more sense to look at the actual cost. That is, what did it cost us to provide the jet, and then base your percentage on that. If you take the other analysis, what is the benefit to the recipient, then you would look at, well, what was the alternative? What benefit did the campaign avoid having to incur because the governor or whomever was flying on state aircraft?
And just a follow-up question, and what's the current, which definition do we use now, cost to state or benefit to recipient?
Currently, it's based on the benefit to the recipient. So it's based on what the alternative would have cost.
I see. Senator McGuire, you had a question. Thank you for waiting patiently.
I'm okay.
other questions or follow-up for Mr. Jones on these points?
If I may, Mr. Chairman,
please.
I wanted to explain a little bit more about some of the considerations that went into the conclusion that we reached in the opinion that I wrote. You know, sometimes, as you mentioned, it can be really difficult to distinguish between what's a campaign activity and what's performing your official state duties. Am I going to a bill signing because that's going to get me in front of a camera?
Right.
Or because I'm doing the people's work, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing? Am I touring a facility because it gives me a photo opportunity, or because I'm really interested in that as part of my official duties? Those things are difficult to distinguish. It's also important to remember that the Ethics Act and the rules that we establish under the Ethics Act apply top to bottom, not just to the governor and lieutenant governor, but all the way down to the lawyers in the Department of Law and everybody in between. So we need to come up with rules that are going to apply across the board and not say, well, because you're the governor, we're going to apply this more harshly and forget about the implications on others.
And just while you're talking about the opinion, I have to ask, the document that I have is stamped confidential. Has that been, I take it that's been waived?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That has been waived.
I was just a little nervous about it.
Yeah,
I'm glad you talked about it first and not me.
Mr. Chairman,
the
2006 opinion that we issued, the one that I wrote, had confidentiality waived right away by the former administration. I referred in that opinion to a 2004 opinion on use of the King Air. The Palin administration, the governor's office, waived confidentiality for that last week.
Thank you.
Good.
More questions, comments for Mr. Jones while we have him here. Senator Terrio.
Well, just touching on the one of the comments you made about, well, people are flying on a corporate jet, and whether that's appropriate. I wasn't sure what you were referring to. I know there were a number of legislators that flew down and took a tour of the Southeast Alaska Intertie Project, and I think they probably flew commercial down to Ketchikan or wherever they took off from, but then I think helicopters probably took them along the route to see the route, the work that had been done, and I'm wondering if it's analogous to that.
No, I was more thinking of a more apples-to-apples comparison between candidates who are either made a gift of travel or invited to travel on corporate jets going from campaign spot to campaign spot, and comparing that, if you will, with a governor using a state aircraft to go from campaign spot to campaign spot. I don't think either one's acceptable. I don't think either one's, you know, they should both be reported the same, and the monetary value of each should be reported so that the public knows, or paid back if it's a state aircraft, so that you know, it's fair.
Okay, well, as an elected official, if I do something of that nature, receive a benefit that's for a legislative purpose, number one, it has to be for a legislative purpose,
right,
and it has to be disclosed.
Right.
But are you talking about just
campaigning?
A new candidate
campaign,
so they're not an elected official.
Well, if you're campaign, it'd be, again, two questions. You could be running for your election and going out to tour, say, the Pebble Mine. If you're going to tour the Pebble Mine, I think that's a legislative purpose, and that's fair. But if someone's flying you in a jet to you know, from one city to another for a campaign purpose, then you should be reporting that full value and so forth.
Well, I think as an elected official, I'm prohibited from doing that, taking that. There's no legislative purpose, so it's a gift with no legislative purpose. And if I am in an election cycle, it would be a contribution from a corporate that's disallowed. So
I agree. I couldn't. I'm not suggesting that the laws be made more lax. I'm just trying to suss out some of the examples you hear about, things that happen.
on that point, Mr. Chairman, I know what you're getting at. And to the extent that this current administration is interested, most of us don't get invited to fly in corporate jets and aren't campaigning for those kinds of offices that would require, although maybe some districts, maybe like Lyman Hoffman's would be big enough that you would do something like that. There are, I believe, IRS rules that you could look to. You might want to think about that in crafting how you evaluate corporate jet travel. And there is a test and a way to do that that the IRS has crafted, I believe. So it's just something to think about for the future. If this administration wants to continue with the policy of benefit to the recipient, so be it. But there are other ways of calculating that value.
Senator McGuire, through the chair, I don't know that this administration has made that as a policy call. It has been the practice for many years preceding this prior administration to allocate costs on that basis. And as I understand it, it's been the practice for more than 10, perhaps more than 15 years. Of course, we didn't have the jet until the last administration, but the King Air costs were allocated on a similar basis. So it's nothing that was new to this last administration, nor is it anything that the current administration has made a conscious decision to adopt as a policy matter. And Mr. Chairman, there were a couple other considerations that I didn't get to that I thought might interest the committee that I took into account when we were putting together this 2006 memorandum. One of those is the fact that when the governor goes to a particular town, for example, to conduct state business, and also has a campaign activity that the governor wants to conduct in that town, one of the alternatives would have been to require the governor to make two trips, one on state aircraft, one on commercial aircraft. And the time that the governor spends in travel will limit, to some extent, the governor's availability to perform other state duties. And if we require the governor, lieutenant governor, whoever is in the executive branch, to make duplicate trips for those sorts of activities, there is some cost to the state. But again, the point is to bring people back to a level playing field so that there isn't a benefit to the person from using state resources for any partisan political activities. And particularly with respect to the governor, this is where the governor's interests sort of diverge a little bit from the rest of the executive branch. The governor has security requirements. And when the governor goes somewhere, the governor takes security. There may be reasons that are related to security for the governor to take state aircraft some places or to use state vehicles in some instances that wouldn't apply to all other executive branch officials.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One other thought, just looking forward as this administration, and I'll point out the recent memo from your governor illustrates the difficulty, and I think our chairman did a good job responding, that you don't always come up with the right answer right away. And, you know, quality is important in crafting these policies. And so I think we need to be careful. And I think we've done a good job of toning down the rhetoric about how quickly we get these bills out. There are things that you're conceding today that this administration is sort of carrying forward in terms of policies that have been in place for years. And I think she will do a good job of thinking through how she wants to craft new policies in the future that may not be represented in this bill today. One other thought on the issue of corporate jet travel, state jet travel, rather, would be the better word, might be a percentage approach. And the chairman talked about it briefly, but I see your point, and I think the practicality issue is compelling, because if you're required to sort of fly back from one city to another, get on an Alaska Airlines flight, pay for it out of campaign funds and come back to that same community to conduct an activity that is completely partisan and political right that same day, you deprive the state to a degree of access to the governor, the lieutenant governor, and I think it's impractical. That said, maybe what we want to do is think more about, you know, percentage allocation and reimbursement for that time. And kind of I'm thinking of in the lawyer world, you do billables, and you kind of keep track of everything you're doing while you're doing it. And it is a pain. But so the date is the 12th of March, and you march through your day, and this is the time you're spending on case X and case Y and case Z. And so maybe this is the time you're spending doing state time. This is the time you're spending doing political time, and there's a value that could be created or generated out of that.
Other questions or comments? Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Jones, the Title 10 provision, which the governor has access to, what does that give us any implications that maybe we haven't talked about?
Senator Huggins,
the National Guard helicopter that's operating under Title 10. Does that create any additional considerations that we might want to?
Senator Huggins, through the chair, I had not thought through that, and I'd need additional time, I think, to think that over. Okay. I presume that whenever the governor would be using the Guard helicopters, it would be strictly for state business, that there wouldn't be any partisan political activities involved. But that is an assumption.
Yeah, because, I mean, those helicopters change missions based on which chapter they're operating under. In Title 10, they're federal, and otherwise they're state properties. Just a question. So.
Thank you, Senator Huggins. Senator Terrio.
Well, I think that we probably do need some discussion on that point. Years ago, I participated in a trip out to Western Alaska and flew out on a C-130. We overnighted in Nome. We, you know, just went out and had dinner, but there could have been some kind of activity for Representative Foster that night that could have touched on political, so getting an answer to that, I think, would be helpful. I'd like to just, if I could go to a different subject.
Please.
Just wondering, Mr. Jones, if you, on behalf of the executive, have given any real thought to the amendment that I had on Monday last week that dealt with the loss of retirement benefits if a person is, in fact, convicted of an ethics breach that rose to the level of a felony and loss of the governmental contributions to their pension from the date of the bad act, and how the executive would look at the proposal of an amendment to this bill that would take care of that for executive branch employees and potentially for legislative personnel.
Senator Terrio, through the chair, I have not discussed that with the legislative director. I would find it very difficult to imagine that anyone would argue with the principle behind it. There may be some disagreement over the details in terms of working it out, but the principle of withholding a state benefit from someone who abuses public office, I think, would be universally accepted.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Terry, do you have an amendment prepared for today?
I do not for today. Well, I've got the language that I had on the floor, but it's not drafted to this CS.
Why don't we do this then? We got this opinion, the packet of material, just about at noon today, and I know it's a fairly thick packet, and I didn't have a chance to read it all. Why don't we carry this bill over to the next hearing? I've got another provision I'm interested in while we've got this bill in front of us. Talking about at that hearing. You've got something you're interested in talking about at that hearing. And so with that, unless there's other questions or comments for the time being from the committee on the bill, or carry it over to the next hearing for Wednesday. With that, the Judiciary Committee in a snowstorm is adjourned.